From NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, why the Iraqi constitution may cause more unrest in that country. We'll speak with a leading Iraqi Sunni about why Sunnis object to the document. But first, President Bush today attacked critics who are demanding the troops be brought home from Iraq immediately. He accused them of, quote, advocating a policy that would weaken the United States. The president, speaking to reporters in the Tamarack Resort in Idaho, also praised Iraq's efforts to approve a new constitution. He said a Democratic constitution for the country would be an important change in the broader Middle East, and that reaching agreement on such a document after years of dictatorship was not easy. Iraq's leaders face a deadline of Thursday to approve the document, and with us to discuss it now is Noah Feldman. He's law professor at New York University. He has also advised parties to the drafting of the country's interim constitution. And Professor Feldman, does this constitution do what a constitution should do? In other words, does it set forth a vision and instructions for how Iraq should be governed?
It does provide those basic directions, and that's crucially important. It also guarantees the equality of all citizens, men and women, Muslims and non-Muslims, and it protects basic rights. That said, it does not achieve what's probably the most important goal of any constitution, and that is producing some sense of national consensus among the major demographic groups in the country, because at least so far, Sunnis have not fully bought into the constitution, even though Shia Arabs and Kurds are, on the whole, supportive of the draft.
And what is it that they object to?
They object primarily to a provision that says that any of Iraq's governorates, there are 18 governorates, can get together and form themselves into a geographical region, which will then have substantial power vis-a-vis the central government. They've more or less come to terms with the fact that the Kurdish governorates in the north are going to gather together to form a Kurdish region, which has basically existed already, practically speaking, for most of the last decade. But the Sunni Arabs have not fully accepted the possibility that in the southern part of the country, which is Shia-dominated, in which there is a great deal of oil, we'll see the banding together of different governorates to found a kind of large mega-region which would control a great deal of oil and would potentially be adverse to the interests of the Sunnis, who mostly, though not exclusively, live in the center of the country.
A lot of people were worried that this constitution would make Sharia or Islamic law dominant. Is that what indeed happened?
Islamic law is central to the document. The Constitution says that Islam is the official religion. It says that Sharia is a main source of legislation, or you might translate it as a principal source of legislation. It also says that no law passed by the new government shall contradict the principles of Islam. And yet, at the same time, it's also a democratic constitution guaranteeing equality and stating that no law shall contradict the principles of democracy or the basic freedoms that are guaranteed in the Constitution. So what we're seeing is an experiment in a new kind of democratic government, which you might call Islamic democratic government. It wants to be truly Islamic in a very thoroughgoing way, but simultaneously true to the principles of democracy. And that's a very great challenge for Iraq to take on. On the other hand, it's a very significant historical fact that they're trying that.
Well, is it a contradiction?
There will be tensions between these two sides of the equation for certain, and individual cases will raise them. So, for example, let's imagine that the legislature passes a law that says that family law shall be governed by classical Islamic law, and that makes it harder for women to initiate a divorce than it does for men. And women come to the courts and say, look, we're equal citizens according to this constitution, and this principle of Islamic law violates our equality. It will then be up to the courts and perhaps the legislature to figure out what the right balance between these things might be. So there will be tensions, but I do not believe that it's a fundamental contradiction. In fact, to the contrary, many, many people in the Muslim world increasingly believe, not all, but many increasingly believe that Islam and democracy are wholly compatible with one another.
But it does not specifically outline the rights of women.
It, in fact, does say that women are equal to men, a provision which notably is absent from our U.S. Constitution. And the draft also guarantees that 25% of the seats in what will be the national legislative body, the so-called Council of Deputies, are reserved for women. So there's a set-aside of 25% of the seats in the legislature for women. Again, that would put the Iraqis well beyond where women are in the national Congress and Senate in the United States.
What does it mean when in the document where it says Iraq is part of the Islamic world and Arabs part of the Arab nation?
That's a classic compromise formulation. Traditionally, in recent years at least, Iraq has always identified itself as an Arab nation, as part of the Arab world. And throughout the Arab world at various times, the ideology of pan-Arab identity has been very, very significant. However, the Kurds in the northern part of the country are not Arabs. They speak a language other than Arabic. They're ethnically distinct from Arabs. And they are, of course, a substantial part of this new nation. And they objected to the idea that Iraq would include language saying that the new constitution would include language saying that Iraq was part of the Arab world. So they came up with this compromise, which says, rather, that those Arabs within Iraq are part of the Arab world, thereby giving each side something that it was looking for.
There are several statements in this constitution restricting the Ba'ath Party. What's that all about?
The Iraqis are well aware that in the former Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries, after several years had passed since the collapse of communism, communist parties essentially reemerged, sometimes under new names, sometimes even occasionally under the old names, and regained a substantial amount of political power in some instances. They don't want that happening in their own country. They're concerned that the Ba'ath Party remains organized in Iraq, sort of under the surface, and that it in fact plays some role in the insurgency. And they want a strong, not just symbolic, but practical statement prohibiting that political organization from reemerging in organized politics.
But the Sunnis, I understand, object to that, thinking that it singles them out for persecution.
Sunnis are very concerned that the label Ba'athist could be used to exclude them from good government jobs, from government resources, and from political participation. And indeed, the Ba'ath Party was disproportionately Sunni. Not every Sunni was a member of the Ba'ath Party, but there were many more Sunnis in the party than there were Shia or Kurds. So that remains a real possibility. And the trick here is to balance a very natural desire for doing justice and overcoming the fact that the Ba'ath Party really was the mechanism through which, one of the most important mechanisms through which Saddam dominated Iraq, with the need for practical reconciliation going forward. So the de-Ba'athification issue has become, in the minds of many Sunnis, a kind of stand-in for the question of how they will be treated in the new Iraq.
New York University law professor Noah Feldman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.